Good morning, everyone. On a beautiful Tuesday, May 12th, 2026, I'll be reading to you from the Herald and Review. This is Jane speaking. One of the big headliner stories, again, has to do with those darn data centers we keep talking about. Mayors divided on data centers. Cities see revenue as concerns over energy, water use mount up. The Illinois General Assembly continues to debate what to do about data centers, or data centers, depending how you pronounce it, as the artificial intelligence business keeps booming and communities complain about their energy bills, noise, and environmental impacts. Data centers are warehouse-like buildings that house computer servers and other infrastructure that power the internet, cloud storage, and more. But massive data centers are necessary to power AI and other high-level computing. Developers of the facilities tout property tax revenue, economic development, and job creation as reasons for local governments to approve projects that could require as much energy as the city itself or more. Opinions on these economic benefits differ. Some Illinois mayors say data centers have worked miracles in their towns, while others question whether the benefits overcome the downsides and whether the benefits are as good as advertised. Property tax revenue from data centers can be significant, but many say the massive centers aren't worth the millions of gallons of water they consume or the stress they put on an already struggling electric grid. The ComEd territory in northern Illinois, for example, has enough large load energy projects in its queue to more than double the amount of energy demand in the territory by 2040. Quote, if all the projects in our pipeline come to be and they all reach their maximum, requested demand will more than double our system peak it took us 120 years to achieve, roughly by 2040. Max Leichtman, the Director of Economic and Workforce Development at ComEd, told a committee earlier this year. The recently approved Cyrus One data center in Sangamon County is projected to bring $500 million in capital investments to the county. Mark Ayers, a former Sangamon County board member, said it's estimated to generate $5 million to $6 million in property taxes annually, with around $98 million in tax revenue over the next 20 years. A memo from the Director of Community Development in Joliet projected the Joliet Technology Center, a planned 795-acre data center project that was approved in March, would generate approximately $310 million in property taxes over 30 years, plus $40 million in utility taxes, in addition to standard industrial water and sewer rate revenues. DeKalb Mayor Cohen Barnes said the Meta data center, that has been operational since 2023, has contributed significantly to the city with community investments and around 250... Ooh, I'm having a hard time reading that number. Anyway, it's a big number, maybe $250 million in utility taxes. The city has one Meta hyperscale data center constructed in 2020, and it recently passed a proposal for the development of a second. When Meta first came to our community, they specifically said they wanted to make a significant impact in everything, and that's just what they did, Barnes said. But then, from property taxes, that's where the magic happens. From 2021 to 24, according to property tax records, Goldframe LLC, a Meta subsidiary, paid a total of $48.5 million for the three sites. That's money, Barnes said, that goes back to the city services and public schools. Meta, right now, is our largest economic impact in our small community in the city of DeKalb, Barnes said. Across three properties, 60.9% of Meta's property taxes are paid to School District 428 in DeKalb, according to records. Barnes said that revenue allowed the district to build a new school, Mitchell Elementary, which opened in 2025. The company has also invested millions in grants for the city's nonprofit community and partnered with Northern Illinois University to improve STEM education for local high schoolers. Barnes said the city didn't require Meta to sign any agreements for those investments ahead of time, but making these investments is in their interests. Quote, "They know that wherever they go, if they build a data center that is not friendly to the community, and if they operate on an annualized basis, not in a partnership way, that could impact them from being able to build the next data center," he said. The data center was billed $31.1 million for property taxes in 2025. Other benefits. Brad Teets, the Midwest Policy Director for the Data Center Coalition, told a House committee in April that data centers are crucial to the modern economy, especially as it becomes more dependent on computing. The data center industry is the 21st century infrastructure. Just like roads and bridges supported the industrial economy, data centers underpin today's digital economy. New data centers are being constructed and coming online all the time. One estimate suggests data center capacity will double by 2030, and the growth is driven largely by investments in AI. Data centers can have big footprints in the places where they're constructed. Lawmakers earlier this session held hours of hearings on their impacts on water, energy use, and the environment. John Lesh, the mayor of Aurora, said the 5 operational data centers in his community have provided generous tax payments, but those benefits don't outweigh the downsides data centers can bring to communities. The data centers provide approximately $1.6 million in property and utility taxes every year, he told a House committee in April. But Aurora residents have complained about constant low-level noise from data centers that came online in 2025 and raised other concerns. But during our public hearings, we heard residents ask, "Is that $1.6 million worth the noise pollution and the strain on our power grid and potential long-term risk to our climate?" Lash said. Teets emphasized benefits beyond property taxes. A 2023 study commissioned by the Data Center Coalition showed that from 2022 to 2023, the industry added 115,130 jobs across Illinois and contributed more than $19 million to the state's GDP. Illinois has provided tax incentives for data centers since Pritzker signed bipartisan legislation in 2019. According to the state's 2024 report, at least 27 data centers have received incentives totaling $983 million in estimated lifetime tax breaks and benefits. Beyond the taxes, data centers invest directly in communities in which they are located through community benefit funds and other mechanisms, Teets said. Community benefit agreements are common for large developments. In Cedar Rapids, Iowa, 2 data center developers are required to invest in the city's community betterment fund, though the city council decides how the money will be used. Other agreements require things like investments in education and infrastructure. When it comes to job growth, the picture is more mixed. Most of the job growth from data centers comes during the facility's construction. Barnes said the data center in DeKalb employed more than 1,000 union construction workers over the 5 years it took to build. Now, he said, there are hundreds of permanent jobs working on tech, electricity, and maintaining the HVAC systems. Regulations and ordinances. In March, Aurora enacted ordinances that would require data center developers to conduct and submit studies dealing with noise, water consumption, and energy needs. The ordinances also require future data centers to meet standards for noise, vibrations, water use, and energy use. They will also need to get power from renewable energy sources. Quote, "We also realize that while Aurora did our best to address these concerns locally, we need to be acting regionally as a state," Lesh said, encouraging state lawmakers to pass regulations like those found in the Power Act, a major bill currently being debated in the General Assembly. The bill would require data centers to pay for their own energy and the infrastructure to generate it, mandate transparency from data centers about their water use, and obtain permits from Illinois Environmental Protection Agency for how data centers handle wastewater and meet efficiency standards. It would also require community benefits agreements that promote transparent engagement with the public. Despite three hearings in the House and one in the Senate, it's unclear whether the bill will pass this spring or if there's more work to be done. And here's a little good news from Washington for those of you who are watching the price at the gas pump very closely. Trump says federal gasoline tax will be reduced until it's appropriate. I assume that means appropriate to lift it. President Donald Trump said on Monday he will reduce the 18-cent federal gas tax for a yet-to-be-determined period as U.S. fuel prices shoot higher due to the Iran war. Waiving the tax requires Congress, currently controlled by Trump's fellow Republicans, to pass legislations. "Yeah, I'm going to reduce," Trump told reporters on whether he would suspend the tax. Asked how long he would suspend it, Trump said in the Oval Office, "till it's appropriate." And as I said, till it's appropriate to no longer reduce it. Just to be clear. U.S. Senator Josh Hawley, a Missouri Republican, said on X that he is introducing legislation on Monday to suspend the gas tax. In March, some Democrats, including Senator Mark Kelly of Arizona, first proposed suspending the tax, which generates about $2.5 billion per month in road funding, until October. Since 2008, more than $275 billion, including the $118 billion from the 2021 infrastructure law, has been shifted from the general fund to pay for road repairs. Trump told CBS earlier on Monday that a bailout plan for airlines, which are struggling with the surging jet fuel costs, had not really been presented and that the airlines are doing not badly. Energy Secretary Chris Wright on Sunday told NBC News Meet the Press that the Trump administration was open to suspending the federal gas tax. U.S. states also tax gasoline, with Indiana, Kentucky, and Georgia moving to make cuts to give consumers some relief at the pump. Gas prices have risen since the war in Iran began on February 28th, with 1 gallon in the U.S. averaging now $4.52 as of Monday, the highest since 2022 when the average peaked at $5.01 a gallon, according to AAA Motor Club. Rising fuel costs, which stand to also boost the price of groceries and other goods, are a vulnerability for Trump and his fellow Republicans who are trying to hold control of Congress in the midterm elections in November. Trump said he knows the tax is only a small percentage of the overall cost of gasoline for consumers, but it's still money, he says. Well, it may be painful to fill your gas tank, but it also may be painful simply to drive. Here's an article about driving discomfort. What to do if arthritis makes getting behind the wheel a painful proposition. Whether you're going to work, running errands, visiting family and friends, or taking long journeys, you probably move around the community behind the wheel of a car. Painful joints can make the combination of arthritis and driving challenging. You might not have to give up on pain-free driving if you follow some practical tips for staying comfortable in the driver's seat. Start with the basics. Depending on which joints are affected and to what degree, arthritis can cause various problems, including pain, decreased joint mobility, and reduced strength. With age, many people also notice a decline in proprioception, which is the automatic sense of your body's position and movement, and balance issues. If your goal is to continue to drive, it's important to address functional limitations by keeping up with doctor visits, managing pain, exercising regularly, and seeing a physical therapist or occupational therapist, says Amy Dondabedian, an occupational therapist and certified driving rehabilitation specialist at Harvard-affiliated Spalding Rehabilitation. A consistent exercise routine that strengthens muscles in the abdomen and those surrounding the joints can ease osteoarthritis symptoms. Weight-bearing and balance exercises are also helpful, she says. Adaptive devices. When you get into the car, think about the specific issues you have and look for adaptive devices designed to make driving easier for people with arthritis. Some options. If you have trouble getting in and out of the car without feeling pain or losing your balance, try using a car handle assist. This handle, which is shaped like the grip of a cane, hooks onto the door latch while the car door is open to give you something to lean on for support. Install a seatbelt extender if you have trouble reaching to pull out the belt. To raise the height of the seat or make it more comfortable, use a cushion. If your fingers are stiff or sore from arthritis in your hands, use a steering wheel cover to help with gripping. If your car doesn't have easily keyless ignition system, use a large-handled key turner to make it easier to start the engine. If you have trouble turning your neck, consider adding extra side-view mirrors or a panoramic rear-view mirror. These are inexpensive and easy to install. Some newer vehicles include the option of extra mirrors. Use a rear-view camera when backing up, or consider having one installed if your car doesn't have one. Switch the floor mats to lightweight ones, which are easier to remove to clean, reducing the strain on your hands and shoulders. Making your own modifications might not solve all your problems. That's when a certified driver rehabilitation specialist, or CDRS, can help. This professional will evaluate you and your vehicle and make personalized recommendations. He or she also will assess other abilities essential for driving, such as vision, proprioception, reaction time, and mobility. You can get more information and find a CDRS near you from the Association for Driver Rehabilitation Specialists website, ADED.net. That's ADED, one word, .net. A clinical assessment can cost about $300. Another option is the CarFit program. This collaboration between AARP and the American Occupational Therapy Association offers free in-person online events. Trained experts will observe you and suggest adjustments to enhance your comfort, safety, and fit in your vehicle. Know your limits. In addition to making modifications to your vehicle, be aware of what's happening in your body. Don't push past your limits. If you're having a day when pain is worse, that's not the day to do five errands in the car, Donabedian says. If you're going on a long-distance drive, share the driving and take breaks. Finally, don't forget to check the potential side effects of any medications you take. Some arthritis pain relievers cause drowsiness or slower reaction times. Position yourself for driving. How you sit in your car can make a difference in your comfort level. Amy Donabedian, a certified driving rehabilitation specialist, offers this advice. Adjust your seat so that your buttocks and knees are at about the same level. Your eyes should be positioned at the level of the base of the rearview mirror, and your line of sight should be clear, she says. Make sure you can reach the steering wheel and pedals without strain. If the car seat doesn't provide adequate support for your lower back, use a small lumbar pillow. Your head should be level and aligned with your spine. Don't hunch forward. I think that's what a lot of people do. I can see it when I look around at stoplights, at the way people are positioned in their cars. So this is all excellent advice. Here's some advice that some of us grandparents might want to be aware of. Sometimes we love to give our grandchildren sweet things, but be careful. Some of those have caffeine in them. This article is Behind the Buzz, a look at the effects of caffeine on children. A cup of coffee or tea in the morning or an afternoon caffeine pick-me-up is usually fine for most adults, but parents might want to take a closer look at caffeine and other ingredients in the drinks their kids love. Many popular beverages that kids go to for quick energy have a surprising amount of caffeine. Some drinks have other stimulants too. These energy-boosting ingredients quickly add up in a smaller body. Caffeine-related visits to U.S. emergency departments nearly doubled among middle and high school students between 2017 and 2023. In 2023, poison control centers recorded a 24% rise in calls about young people with reactions to energy drinks. Here's what parents and caregivers need to know about caffeine and how to guide children and teens toward healthy drinks. There is no biological need for caffeine. Caffeine is a stimulant that boosts alertness, energy, and brain activity. Coffee and cacao beans, tea leaves, guarana berries, and kola nuts are all natural sources of this drug, but it can also be made synthetically and added to foods, drinks, and medicines. Caffeine side effects can include fast or irregular heartbeat, elevated blood pressure, rapid breathing, anxiety, nausea, restlessness, diarrhea, and sleep loss. A child's growing body and brain are more sensitive to their stimulation by caffeine. Caffeine can stay in the body for more than 8 hours, depending on a person's metabolism. When the caffeine wears off, children may have a headache and feel irritable or tired. Caffeine can get in the way of other nutrients that help kids grow. They may eat less fruit, vegetables, lean protein, and healthy grains after filling up on soda, energy drinks, protein bars, and other ultra-processed foods with caffeine. Caffeine affects kids' sleep. Not getting enough sleep or not sleeping well or long enough can affect thinking, mood, digestion, and ability to avoid getting sick. Sleep loss leads to school struggles and robs kids of the energy they need for activities they enjoy. Studies suggest that some kids are more sensitive to caffeine than others, but we need more research to fully answer this question. Research found that males were more likely to visit the emergency department for caffeine-related symptoms than females. Kids who take stimulant medications for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or to treat other conditions may have sleep problems, irritability, and mood shifts when they consume caffeine. The American Academy of Pediatrics says avoiding caffeine is the best choice for all kids. Families should keep food, drinks, and medicines with caffeine out of reach. For most adults, consuming less than 400 milligrams of caffeine per day is generally not associated with side effects. Talk to your doctor if you are pregnant or breastfeeding. People with some health conditions or who take certain medications may be more sensitive to caffeine. Classic coffee mugs hold about 10 ounces. Supersized coffee drinks are often 16 to 20 ounces and can have up to 490 milligrams of caffeine, already over the 400 milligram level for adults. Iced, chilled, and frozen coffee drinks also contain caffeine. For example, a 13.7-ounce bottled Starbucks Frappuccino has 110 milligrams of caffeine, and a Dunkin' iced coffee has 197 milligrams of caffeine. Energy drinks can pack a dangerous caffeine punch, which might be why so many labels carry warnings that the drink is meant for adults only. They come in fruity, candy-like flavors that appeal to kids. Some drinks are sugar-free, but others have high amounts of sugar that can amplify the effects of the drink. Energy drinks with caffeine may also have other ingredients like taurine, guanara, ginseng, and L-carnitine. Some sodas are sources of caffeine as well. For example, 12-ounce serving of Pepsi Zero Sugar, 38 milligrams. Diet Coke, 46 milligrams. Mountain Dew, 54 milligrams, and Mountain Zevia, 55 milligrams. Caffeine can hide out in foods, too. A 3.5-ounce dark chocolate bar might have anywhere from 50 to 150 milligrams of caffeine. Ice cream, protein bars, chocolate chips, energy bars, and even chewing gum can have hidden caffeine. Nutrition labels do not have to list caffeine content. That's very important. Nutrition labels do not have to list caffeine content. There's no requirement. Prescription and over-the-counter drugs such as medicines for migraine headaches, menstrual discomfort, nasal congestion, or muscle pain may also have caffeine. The best way to steer kids away from caffeine is to talk to them about making healthy choices. You can encourage them to drink water instead and make sure they are getting enough sleep. The stimulation of caffeine is not a substitute for sleep. It's important to teach kids to trust the signals their bodies are sending them, especially when it comes to caffeine consumption. A caffeine overdose can be dangerous. Get medical help right away if your child had a large amount of caffeine and has symptoms such as racing or irregular heartbeat, fast breathing, body shakes that your child can't control, called tremors, anxious feelings, or the inability to sit still, or hyperactivity. And since we're talking about dangers for minors, proposed ban on indoor tanning for minors has been scrapped by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Days before the 2024 presidential election, future Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy posted a statement on X promising to end the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's, quote, aggressive suppression of such alternative therapies as raw milk, ivermectin, psychedelics, and somewhat perplexingly, sunshine. While the post did not explain how the FDA was limiting Americans' access to the sun, many dermatologists were dismayed when Kennedy abruptly withdrew a proposed FDA rule that would have banned minors from using devices that mimic sunlight or indoor tanning lamps. The rule, which was withdrawn March 16th, would have also required indoor tanning facility users to sign a form acknowledging the risk of cancer, early skin aging, and other health effects. Kennedy's action comes at a time when many adherents of his Make America Healthy Again, the MAHA movement, have adopted regular sun exposure as a core principle of wellness, with social media influencers encouraging followers to abandon sunscreen and build up their solar callus or sun tolerance instead. The trend has frustrated many dermatologists who warn that the damage from frequent sunburns and tans accumulates over a lifetime, and those acquired early in life appear to play a disproportionate role in later risk of skin cancer. The Skin Cancer Foundation notes also that you cannot build up a tolerance to sun exposure. There is no such thing as solar callus. Dermatologists have long cautioned that indoor tanning lamps are no less dangerous since they expose users to ultraviolet light at concentrations far above natural sunlight. Like sunlight, the lamps emit two different types of ultraviolet wavelengths, UVA, which are longer and penetrate more deeply into the skin, and UVB, which are shorter and more easily burn the outer layers. Both light sources darken the skin through the same biological process. UV rays change the structure and chemical profile of DNA in the skin, which then produces more melanin in order to prevent further damage. A tanning bed session exposes users to UVB rays akin to those at noon at the equator, an intense experience, but at least one with a terrestrial equivalent, says Hunter Shane, an associate professor of dermatology at UC San Francisco. The UVA radiation in a tanning bed is roughly 15 times that found anywhere on the surface of the planet. They're really blasting you with these super physiological doses of UV radiation that you couldn't even find in a natural environment. The World Health Organization counts UV-emitting tanning beds as a group 1 carcinogen, alongside other known human carcinogens like cigarettes and asbestos. One study Shane co-authored found that tanning beds accelerate DNA mutations in parts of the body not typically exposed to the sun, leading to a nearly threefold increase in indoor tanners' lifetime melanoma risk. Rates of melanoma diagnoses have increased by 46% in the last decade. The tanning lamp rule, which was first proposed in 2015, focused on age as a specific risk factor. Tanning bed usage before the age of 35 is associated with a 75% increase in the risk of melanoma, the most serious and frequently fatal form of skin cancer.